Tassa Bhagavato Arahato Samma Sambuddhassa. Namo Tassa Bhagavato Arahato Samma Sambuddhassa. Namo Tassa Bhagavato Arahato Samma Sambuddhassa. Buddhaṃ Dhammaṃ Sanghaṃ Namassaṃ. Looking at the Noble Eightfold Path as a path that leads to awakening, to complete freedom, and it's a very practical path. Fortunately, it's something we can do and. And it has results. I'm just reminded before, so tonight I want to speak about right view or right understanding. And I sense Chita mentioned this morning about the Eightfold Path are not steps, that one develops one and then you get that down and then you do the next one, but they're like eight cords that are twisted together to make a really strong cable. I think that's Bhikkhu Bodhi's analogy. It's kind of a lovely image. And yet there is this sequence that they're listed in, and we're going to present them in that way. And as I was looking into the different aspects of right view or right understanding, I can see you can't really separate any of those folds of the path out completely. There's other elements come in. So looking at right view, I can see, oh, there's also right mindfulness and right effort, right livelihood, like a lot of right thought, they all sort of come in there. I will do my best to speak about right view, right understanding in a way that will be hopefully of some benefit. So, the bottom line is that we all want to be happy and we all want to be free from suffering. And we've all tried many ways of gaining happiness, I'm sure. We have different leanings. So for some it's to have certainty and rightness and clarity. For some it's to have sense pleasures more and more, delightful things. For some it may be to be seen as very important or to have lots of great status symbols. There's all these different ways we look for happiness and sense of satisfaction in this ever-changing world. And so the Buddha is pointing to, the ways that we seek happiness that leads to greater unhappiness, and the ways that we seek happiness that can lead to greater happiness and freedom. And right view or right understanding is crucial to this. So just recently I was speaking to somebody who was telling me that when they were in their teens, they realized that they had a lot of negativity, that their mind tended towards criticism and negativity. And then they had the wisdom, actually, and insight to recognize, well, if my mind's like this when I'm 17, what's it going to be like when I'm 45? I better start doing something about this. And so came across the path of Buddhism and is still practicing many years later. And then I was thinking, oh, for myself, it was more like sense pleasures, looking for happiness through the sense world, through some nice experience, some delightful sense experience, and then another one, and a better one, and on it goes. And then recognizing that also is just so disappointing. It just leaves you, and you end up feeling frustrated and And it's like it leads to addiction. It's just like always wanting more. Because however delightful the sense experience is, and they can be very, very delightful, you know, it ends, and then we want something else. We want it back, or we want better, or we want to relive it. So there's this endless process of seeking happiness in the wrong places. So for me, that was a strong motivation in my teens to come across the Buddha's teaching and start practicing meditation and start trying to sort out the confusion of this mind a little bit. Still working on it, but it's better than it was. So right view is pointing to a way of there's what's called mundane right view and supramundane right view, these translations. And it may seem, you may think, well, if you can have supramundane right view, why bother with the mundane, you know? Just give me the best. But the mundane is very important, because most of our life is, you know, mundane, isn't it? It's doing the ordinary things. So the mundane right view is pointing to karma. It's pointing to how karma is made. And it's basically pointing to, you know, when we do harm by body, speech or mind, it will have harmful results. And when we do good or make wholesome acts through body, speech or mind, it will have wholesome results. It's like, that's very, very simply put. And then, we might think, well, you know, I'm doing good, I'm doing a lot of good, but I'm still having all this difficult stuff happening. And or you maybe have friends who are really good people and a lot of difficulties happen for them. So it doesn't sort of seem to add up. And, you know, it does take a certain, I guess, a certain amount of faith in a way to take on the law of karma. For me, it's always made sense. I know for some it doesn't, and it does involve the sense of rebirth, that this isn't just a one-off experience, this life, but that there is that there have been many, many lives, and there may be many, many more. And you know, the Buddha points to the samsara, or the constant round of becoming, where the mind stream is constantly seeking something, seeking satisfaction, seeking clarity, seeking pleasure, seeking fulfillment, and then seeking to get away from difficulty, discomfort, physical pain, loss, you know. So that's the kind of movement of the mind. It's very natural. Move towards what's pleasant, move away from what's unpleasant, you know. Amoebas do it, actually, so it's like, it's very basic. but the Buddha is giving us more credit than an amoeba, and recognizing that we can actually, if we put our attention the right way, we can step out of that endless movement away from away from pain and towards pleasure. So, in the context of mundane right view, the precepts that everybody's taken is a huge support for that. So, when we take even the 5 precepts, let alone the 8, we're guiding our body and speech in a wholesome way. So we're restraining ourselves from doing harm by body and speech through the support of those precepts. And in restraining our you know, body and speech from, like, our speech and action, we've got more of an opportunity to work on the mind. So we can, you know, the mind takes a little longer to turn around. Some habits go very deep. And so it can take time to turn the mind around, but if we've made that determination not to verbally harm or physically harm others, then in any of the ways that those precepts cover, then we can then we start to see that maybe the harmful or the greedy or the confused mind states. And through our meditation practice, we can start to see them more clearly, and through seeing them more clearly, we become motivated to work on transforming them. So karma literally is action with intention. So we're refraining from doing harmful action through body or speech. And we can actively cultivate wholesome speech and action, and looking for opportunities to cultivate what is wholesome. So this is basically mundane right view, where we're not anymore, even if we feel like we want to fulfill that greedy thought or that harmful thought. We're not going to do it because we know that it leads to more and more suffering. So it's on the gross level, the five precepts, they cover a very basic level, and then we can take it much, much more deeply, more subtly into our lives. Not harming, not taking what's not given, being responsible with our sexuality, not lying, and or using harmful speech, and sobriety as a support for those. So those are the basics, and then we can take them much, much deeper. And then they support the mundane right view, which leads to just basically a happier life. And the more we cultivate that, the more ease and well-being there is in our life, and the less likely we are to fall into those hellish states that can happen. But according to the Buddha's teaching, it's still within the realms of samsara. So it's not, in and of itself, liberating. It just supports a support for liberation. And the liberating aspect, or the supramundane right view, is the four noble truths. And the Four Noble Truths are also very practical, starting with understanding there is dukkha. So dukkha being often translated as suffering, but really more truly it would be a whole spectrum from suffering to unsatisfactoriness, just from a little kind of like, just a little, I wish it was different to this. That's dukkha, right the way through the spectrum to intense suffering. It's all dukkha, it all has that word dukkha. So he's pointing to dukkha, the cause of dukkha, the cessation of dukkha, and the path that leads to the cessation of dukkha, which is the Noble Eightfold Path. So it comes around, just as Isantachita was saying this morning, they interpenetrate each other, or they both contain aspects of each other, the Eightfold Path and the Four Noble Truths. So these Four Noble Truths, they require, it's an interesting thing, because they require a certain amount of right view to start with. So when we're strongly identified with being somebody, it's very difficult to turn the mind towards dukkha. We can be engulfed by dukkha. We can we can be crippled by dukkha. We can be irritated by dukkha. But it's difficult to really know dukkha if there's a strong sense of self present. So it takes a certain amount of right view already to be interested enough to have a look at the dukkha and where that's arising. So when there's a very strong sense of identity or identification with the dukkha, then we will blame someone else, we'll blame another situation, or we'll blame ourselves. and then we're kind of stuck because we can't, you know, blaming. It can sort of have a temporary relief, but it doesn't really transform anything. In fact, it gets things into a greater tangle. So we need a certain amount of interest and curiosity to look at, like, well, what, oh, you know, what is that dukkha? So it's, you know, the nature of this existence is we cannot be completely without, you know, it's never going to be all nice, and, you know, we're never going to have all joy and no sorrow. We're never going to have all gain and no loss. We're never going to have all success and no failure. It's just not going to happen. They come together, they're pairs, you know. So there's going to be some dukkha arising. And so the Buddha's pointing to, like, don't try and push that away. But if you really want to be happy, and if you really want to be free, turn towards that and get interested in it. So it's very counterintuitive. And so if we remember that, you know, when there is dukkha present, and then we take an interest, like, oh, that's really painful. What is that? So it could be, you know, there can be physical pain, which we need to learn to manage. You know, it's not possible to go through a life without experiencing some physical pain. It generally gets more as we get older. So we can look at our relationship to that. You know, is there fear around physical pain? Is there a tightening around it? Is there aversion? Probably aversion. Probably any of those things. And then recognizing that if we tighten around it, it gets more painful. So we can bring in skillful means, like one way is to breathe through physical pain, so to help to release the physical pain a little bit, or release the tension. So imagine the breath going through painful places in the body. Or we can pay attention to places that are not painful, so we're not locked onto the pain. Or we can reflect on, you know, this is how it is to have a human body, or to have an animal body. And then we can have a sense of compassion or oneness with all sentient beings, all beings who feel. Because everyone who feels will feel pleasure and feel pain. So then we take it out of the little me and mine story into something that's more expansive, and where there's more openness and more letting go. And then there's, of course, the mental or the heart pain that we experience, which can be as difficult or more difficult than the physical pain. And you know, none of us want to experience it, and we don't want others often. I mean, sometimes people do want people to experience, you know, but we don't want our loved ones to experience it. We don't want to. It's not something we enjoy or relish, you know, the heart pain. But it arises, it happens. So, you know, the Buddha's encouraging us to, when that happens, to turn towards it and take an interest in the dukkha. So, and the refrain is, there is dukkha, dukkha should be understood. Dukkha has been understood. So to understand it, I like the image of Ajahn Sumedho. He would say, stand under it. Stand under it and let it rain on you. You know, let yourself be soaked by it. So you're not, there's not that pulling away, but there's a standing under or leaning into. Sometimes there's a sense of leaning into it. And then often what happens when we do that, surprisingly, is a certain amount of the discomfort shifts. Because some of the discomfort is there because we're pulling away, because we're afraid and averse, and trying to control something that is beyond our control. So standing under or leaning into the dukkha, taking an interest, being curious about, you know, where is it in the body? What does it feel like? Where does it come from? All of these things have causes and conditions, and we can start to understand, not to be cerebral about it, but just to be interested, curious. And then the second of the Four Noble Truths is there is a cause of dukkha. And the cause of dukkha should be let go of. And the cause of dukkha has been let go of. So the cause is basically clinging or identification. So when we're holding tightly around something, or we're strongly identified, there is dukkha. That is the cause. So always when we have dukkha, if we trace it back, we find at its core, at its root, is the sense of me and mine. The sense of I am, I want, I don't want, is always there. And the Buddha talks about three kinds of clinging or tanha, thirst, or craving, and the craving for sensual pleasures, the craving of becoming, and the craving to not exist. So I think probably we all experience all of those at different times. We tend to have leanings, you know, towards one or the other. But I think we probably all may recognize voices of those, you know, like the sensual pleasures one we've already spoken about, and that's can be very obvious. And then the craving to become. So it's very strong in our culture. We're supposed to become something, you know. We're supposed to make something of ourselves and be important and have a, you know, make history and be significant in the world and all that stuff. So knowing the voices of becoming in our minds, you know, what do they sound like? We often have a lot of shoulds. Should be this, should be that, should do better. Or they may have a sense of like feeling really good about oneself, like feeling like I am the greatest, you know, I'm the best, I'm fantastic. There are people who have that, and and I'm going to be the best, and I'm going to do it the best, and I'm going to make it the best, and people are going to remember me. I'm going to go down in history, you know. You have that. So that's the becoming voices in the mind, in the heart. And then there's the vibhavatana, the wish to not exist. So there's the very strong ones, you know, the terrible ones, the demons, you could say, of suicidal leanings, which maybe, I certainly experienced those in the past, and maybe a few other people here who have. And I think of them as demons that kind of come and sort of take over the mind, and where everything seems awful and impossible and hopeless and too much, and you just can't do it. And then, you know, those voices get stronger and stronger, and then you start to believe them more and more, and then for many people, sadly, many people follow those voices. Too many people. It's a very, very sad thing, and it happens more than anyone would wish. So those are the voices of the craving to not exist, and that's on its most extreme. It's those suicidal voices, but then there are other little voices like, oh, I'm not really worthy. I'm not really good enough. I'm kind of inherently flawed. I'm not really, you know, I shouldn't really be here in the first place. I'm not really, you know. We have these voices that are conditioned. They're all conditioned. They're not, they don't really belong to us. But they come in. And they can be very quiet little whispers. Who do you think you are? You're not really worthy. Nobody really cares about you, you know. There's something wrong with you. Why do you always do that thing, you know? But those little whispers that can really undermine us. So those are the voices of vibhava tanha, of wanting to not exist, or feeling that we shouldn't exist, we shouldn't be here. And often people have leanings, you know, the vibhava tanha types and the bhava tanha types. So the bhava tanha is the craving to become, and the vibhava tanha is the craving to not exist. So people tend to have leanings, not necessarily that they're always the same, you know, we have a little bit of both, but tend to have leanings. So it's good to know what those leanings are and to counterbalance them as best you can. So if you have a very strong wish to become, just recognizing where the suffering is, that the dukkha is inherently tied up with that. Because even if we do get to become what we want to become, it's going to change. We're going to die, you know, it's going to change, we're going to have to leave it all behind. Even if we make history, at some point somebody's going to forget their history. It doesn't matter. So it's more about what we're doing in the moment. What are we doing now? How are we spending our time? What are we doing with this body now, in any given moment? And then with the vibhava tanha, the wish to not exist, in some ways it can be a similar response, actually. Just quite recently, this thought came, because I had the conditioning of, I'm not really supposed to be here. I'm not really supposed to be here, you know. And then I just had this thought the other day of like, well, I am here. I mean, it's not the first time I've thought that, but well, I am here, so how to make best use of this, you know? So since I'm here, you know, how to make best use of this? What can I do? And not just like as a project, you know, that goes back into the bhava tanha, but now, in this moment, well, since I'm here, maybe it can just cultivate some metta, you know, or let go of the gripes and the niggles, you know. Can I do that? So just little things. It's just little things bring us back onto the path. So anyway, the second of the four noble truths, the noble truth of the cause of dukkha is always connected with clinging. It's always connected with identification, with some sense of I am. It always comes back to that. And there's also, the Buddha talked about three kinds of, he talks about the conceit I am, or having the concept I am. And that we have the concept I am better than, I am worse than, or I am equal to. And all of those are wrong view. I am better than, I am worse than, I am equal to. All of those are wrong view. So basically, any thought of I am is pulling us off track. So that's the second of the Four Noble Truths. So there is a cause. The cause should be let go of. The cause has been let go of. So those are the three aspects of the second noble truth. And the third noble truth is there is cessation of dukkha. And the cessation of dukkha should be realized. And the cessation of dukkha has been realized. So we can recognize little cessations of dukkha. Sometimes people hear that and they've read about, you know, the big cessation, the great cessation of suffering, the final absolute cessation of suffering, which is a wonderful possibility that we work towards. And then that's, but because they're looking at the big cessation, they're looking towards the big cessation, we can miss the little cessations. And the little cessations are very, very important because they happen all the time. So any time we let go of that, we let go of a strong opinion, or we let go of having it our way, or we let go of getting gratified by the sense world, or we let go of any kind of attachment, there is cessation of suffering, dukkha. There's some relief that happens. And then we can often miss that and just go on to the next thing. So recognizing when there are those little moments of letting go. I'm sure already in this time you've been here, it's not been very long, I'm sure there's been a moment or two of letting go. And a little like, ah, here and there, must be. And if you think there hasn't been, it might be that you just haven't noticed. Because they happen all the time, little ones. And those little cessations support our recognizing, first of all, recognizing how cessation happens, how the freedom from, how that letting go happens. How the cessation kind of happens through letting go. So we get to get more familiar with, letting go leads to happiness. Rather than getting things leads to happiness, we get more familiar with that, and also noticing those little cessations support. It's like what we put our attention onto is strengthened by our attention. So if we put our attention on those little cessations, then we notice them more. Then our mind is more inclined towards letting go. So I'm not being super coherent, but anyway, never mind. And then the fourth of the Four Noble Truths is there is a path that leads to the cessation of dukkha, and that path is this Noble Eightfold Path. And the Noble Eightfold Path should be developed, and the Noble Eightfold Path has been developed. So this is the supramundane right view, big word for a very practical, applicable way of meeting our experience. And I think one of the ways we get lost or we give up or we get discouraged is when we think of this practice as a big project, the enlightenment project. And then there's like how we are, and then it can feel like, oh my goodness, it's just hopeless, or then maybe I'll just try it next lifetime or something. But what I love about the teaching or the clarity of the Buddha is he's pointing to just now, like you do it now. Practice it now. You get interested now. You feel what it feels like now. You let go now. And all of these little moments build up and transform the course of this river of life. It transforms it. And the more we're doing that, when we're really present, the story of self hasn't really got any room. It needs time. It needs a history. It needs a plan for the future. It needs time. The story of self. In this present moment, there is. I'm not saying that there aren't past causes and conditions that are here now. There are, but it's just like this. And sometimes this is really great, you know, beautiful. And sometimes this is kind of nothing special, much of the time. And sometimes this is really, really difficult. Sometimes this is really, really painful. But if we can bring the interest to what is happening here now, then whatever it is we're experiencing is all good. It's all good. Even physical pain, feeling like you're having a breakdown, you know, going through immense grief, is all okay. If we bring that interest and presence to it, it's all okay. And all of those things, you know, come up in our lives. It's not a nice, tidy path. We experience all kinds of stuff. And if we can bring our attention and our interest to what is going on, then the path is right there. There's right view. It's right there. And a very, very close friend of right view is right thought or right intention, which I'll speak more about tomorrow. But I feel like I can't quite speak about right view without right intention. Because we can know what's going on. We can turn our attention to what's going on and see it clearly. And then we, you know, use the same old habits of mind. And then we... So right intention or right thought are thoughts of renunciation, thoughts of compassion, and thoughts of kindness, put in the positive terms. So those are seen as right thought, or in another way of saying it is thoughts of non-sensuality. Thoughts of non-harm and non-ill will. So sometimes actually, I think it's good to have both, because sometimes we can only manage non-harm or non-ill will. We can't quite get the like really good stuff going, but that's still really beneficial. Just to refrain from doing harm, or refrain from following harmful thoughts to oneself or others, towards oneself or others. Or to refrain from getting lost in sensuality, in memories or fantasies or plans that take us away from what is happening here and now. Or you know, thoughts of ill will towards ourselves or towards others, or towards what our experience of what's going on now. I don't want this. I don't want it to be like this. You know? And it's like, okay, I don't want it to be like this. And it's like this, you know. So what are we going to do? We can fight it, or we can be interested. So it's always now. And the path is always here, it's always now. It's always with this situation that we are in, that we find ourselves in at any given moment. And it meets the messiness of this human experience. You know, if we read the suttas, it's all very kind of clear and crisp and, you know, wholesome and unwholesome. It's very simple. And it is, you know, there is wholesome and unwholesome. There's wholesome mind states and unwholesome mind states. There's wholesome speech and unwholesome speech. There's wholesome action and unwholesome action. It's true. And if we get to know that, then we can guide our body, speech and mind in a good way. But there's also the results of past karma, which is mixed. So we have some nice bits and we have some really difficult bits. And some things are kind of spectacular and volatile and arise in the moment, you know, or in it for a period of time. You know, sort of chaos reigns for a while. And sometimes there are those deep underlying trends of mind that just I've kind of cut deep grooves and just keep on. I sort of almost like a constant thread throughout our lives. But all of them can be seen and known. And in the seeing and knowing is the transformation. So some things can change very quickly with our presence and awareness, and some things we just got to be really patient. Really patient, really kind, really steady, really forgiving. And then gradually, just by bringing those qualities to them, gradually, the mind is transforming. So it's very important not to have some idea of being, a perfect person or a good Buddhist, but to be interested in what is going on here now, and what are we bringing to this. Because that's where the transformation happens. So, read a little quote from the Buddha. And this also ties in with right effort, which will come later on. So, the Buddha says, it's in the Anguttara Nikaya Book of Ones. I do not see even a single thing on account of which unarisen, unwholesome qualities arise, and that arisen, unwholesome qualities increase and expand as wrong view. And then he says, I do not see a single thing on account of which unarisen, wholesome qualities arise, and arisen, wholesome qualities increase and expand so much as right view. And he also speaks about two conditions for the arising of right view. Careful attention, so being aware, being interested, careful attention to what's going on, and utterance of another person, someone reminding us. I'm just going to end with a little simile that also the Buddha speaks about. So, and it's connected with in a way, to me it seems to cover both mundane and super mundane right view. But he's speaking about karma and also about applying right view or applying wrong view. And he says, if we begin from wrong view in our experience, if we're starting from a place of wrong view, it's like starting with a bitter seed. And if you take that bitter seed, and he says like a neem, these are Indian plants, a neem, which is a bitter-leafed plant, or a bitter gourd, or a bitter cucumber, and you take the seed of one of those and you plant it in moist soil, then all of the nutriments that seed takes in, all of the goodness that it takes in, all the nutriments, everything it takes in to grow, will all support the growth of a bitter plant. And that's how it is when we come from wrong view. It doesn't matter what we bring in, we're bringing it into a bitter seed, so it's going to result in a bitter plant. And if we start with the seed of right view, then it's like planting a seed of sugar cane or hill rice or grapes, and we plant that seed in the same moist soil, in the same conditions, in the same moist soil, it'll grow a sweet, delicious, delectable plant. So I love that image because the conditions for those two plants are the same. They have the same soil, the same nutriment, the same water. But one starts off with the bitter seed and one starts off with the sweet seed, and the results more and more bitterness or more and more sweetness. So, you know, at any moment, so we might find ourselves in the midst of an enormous sense of oh my goodness, you know, I've been nurturing that bitter seed for a long time and it's really awful. So if we find that, right now, we can plant the sweet seed right in there. Right now we can bring right view to that, we can be interested. We can know the dukkha of it and it starts to transform. And I don't know, I hope you have experienced it, but I've certainly had times when, you know, being in the midst of really, really unpleasant stuff, really difficult, painful, unpleasant stuff, and then just brought that seed of interest, curiosity to it, and then mysteriously it feels like, remarkably, it starts to become sweet. Not that it necessarily goes away, but a sweetness comes into it, because there's a sweetness of truth. There's a sweetness of knowing impermanence. There's the sweetness of not being tightly identified and being curious. So in that interest and curiosity, the sweet seed is sown and then it can start to grow. So I'll offer that tonight.